You're listening to the Get Balanced Podcast with Dr. Donnie, episode 58.
Welcome to the Get Balanced Podcast with Dr. Donnie. If you're a firefighter, law enforcement officer, or emergency medical professional who would like to improve your family relationships, your physical and mental health, and want to have success at work and at home, well, this show is for you. Welcome to the Get Balanced program. Let's get started.
Hey, folks, this is Dr. Donnie, and I am telling you I'm excited that the Get Balanced Podcast has an official sponsor, and I want to tell you a little bit about them. And it is FirstNet, built with the AT&T. And what I want to tell you about them is probably part of it is that many of you already know this, but for first responders and frontline workers, communication, as we know, is not a luxury, but it's a lifesaver. And that's why FirstNet, built with AT&T, was created. Now, the FirstNet mission is to make communication faster, safer, and more collaborative for first responders and other public safety personnel. FirstNet helps first responders and frontline workers connect when they are on and off duty. They get access to priority and preemption capabilities. This means they connect to the network first. In emergency situations, first responders move to the front of the line to access critical bandwidth they need to send and receive, whether it's voice, data, video, images, and text. Now, during an emergency, FirstNet is a critical connection between first responders to technology and also to each other, giving them access to information quickly and when every second counts. With FirstNet, first responders and frontline workers get a highly secure, reliable network with 24/7, 365 customer care and monitoring. Now, to get more information about FirstNet, go visit your local AT&T store or visit FirstNet.com. Now, let me go in and introduce our guest for this week. Hey, folks, welcome to the Get Balanced Podcast with Dr. Donnie. And my special guest this week is Dr. Catherine Coleman. And welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're quite welcome. And Dr. Coleman, if you will, for the listeners, why don't you tell us a little bit about you? And if they recognize your name, perhaps they would, they've watched you in the morning hour. Now, we're not always up that early, but, if you want to touch on that too, because folks, what it is that Dr. Coleman is also on the morning news sometimes quite a bit. And so it's always interesting to see you there as well as all the work that you do. So maybe if you give a little background on you and how you got into therapy and all of that.
Yeah. So I am a board certified police and public safety psychologist. My office is in Scottsdale, Arizona, and that's where I work primarily. But I came here from Colorado, where I did a lot of the same work for about 7 years before coming to Arizona. And so I work exclusively with first responders. First responder wellness is a true passion of mine. And so I really want to help support first responders have the longest career that they want. So I want you to be able to leave the job because you're choosing to retire or because you get to move on to greener pastures, not because you're getting fired or not because you have to leave because of an injury, whether it be physical or mental. So I do quite a bit of wellness program consulting with agencies, training, therapy, responding to critical incidents and helping responders cope, after a lot of those traumas, in addition to pre-employment and, you know, fitness for duty evaluations and stuff like that. So I have got a great gig. I feel like I have the best job in the world. Sometimes I pinch myself the fact that I actually get paid to do this. This job has led me into a really unique path where, as Dr. Donnie mentioned, I get to do kind of really fun appearances on some news channels. So some of you may have seen me on Newsmax. I'm usually on their morning show, Wake Up America, probably on average like once or twice a week, talking about various issues. Sometimes it's pop culture and Britney Spears, which was the most recent one, and her conservatorship. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's talking about, you know, the Surfside building collapse and how it's affecting the emergency responders there. So it's a fun gig, and that's kind of led me to lots of exciting opportunities where I get to, you know, spread my message a little bit further than just at the local level.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome and a great overview. And actually, it sort of leads me into, let's talk a little bit about your work-life balance, because those morning shows come on generally around 6 a.m. Eastern time. And you mentioned you're in Scottsdale, so that's 3 a.m. your time. Talk to me about doing those shows. What's that about?
Do as I say, not as I do, as you listen to this today. Yes. So I mean, like you, Dr. Donnie, I preach work-life balance to the people that I work with, but I am far from an expert. So I learn a lot from you and listening to your podcast as well. So on the days where I have to do a morning show, thankfully they try to put me on towards the second half of the show, which means I'm on anytime between 4:30 and 5:30. You know, I got to do full hair and makeup, and that takes a little bit, especially early in the morning when you're moving a little slower. So that means I'm usually up between about 3:20 or 4:30 a.m., which is really early, especially when you then go and work a full day, you know, 8 to 5 afterwards.
Yes.
So, yeah. So, and the hard thing is too, is that, you know, when you have an appearance, I usually don't find out until the day before. I usually have less than 24 hours notice when something like that happens. So, there's not a lot of preparation, because normally you can kind of, you know, flex your sleep schedule or, plan ahead, but not, you know, or have a light day the day before, or, you know, a lighter day at work,
right,
you know, the day of. That would be an ideal situation, but, I don't have that luxury. So, I work on a lot less sleep on those days, and I have to find time to make up for it later on. The other week I actually laid on the floor in my office for 15 minutes and took a nap on a hard floor.
Oh, wow. Now, wait a minute, you're a therapist. We all picture the nice sofa in there.
What? There's a sofa. It's not big, and I'm tall. It's not big enough for me.
Oh, well, as we're talking about work-life balance, I would like to refresh the listeners and any new listeners out there. I want to go over sort of where my philosophy and my approach has been in my research with work-life balance. And my research was published just 2 years ago. And what I did is I did this study with these five individual case studies. And what they were is they did very, very well in their careers, and they were all leaders in their fields in different industries. And the interesting thing about it, they were very effective in their careers, and they were very happy and successful with their families. And then I really dug into it, and sort of the underpinning of it was, hey, how do they do their self-care? And when I talk about self-care, you know, which we talk about in the first responder world all the time, right? Physical health, mental health, but yeah, from the physical health, how did they eat? How did they exercise? How much sleep did they get? Did they take their preventive medicines and get their preventive exams and all of that? And then the mental health, to did they have positive emotions in their, you know, in their daily work and in their environment? But what did they do on that mental health side? And then also their social health, social wellness, and also their spiritual wellness. And what I found was is that all five of these folks, men and women, they all mastered their self-care. And at the end of the study, basically, they swore by, it's because they put themselves first, you know, that physical health and taking care of their mental health, their social health, and their spiritual health, they were more effective at work and with their families. And it was amazing how they were all so similar. And so that led to a model, and then that's led to a lot of my work that I do today in my workshops. But I wanted to get your take, Dr. Coleman, because, you know, with the actual therapy and the psychotherapy and all the different types of therapies that you do, what role do you think, you know, how well we take care of ourselves, especially as firefighters, law enforcement officers, emergency medicine, the importance of taking care of our physical health and how that relates to our mental health as well. Is there a connection?
There's absolutely a mind-body connection. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of research that suggests, for example, that cardiovascular activity for 30 minutes, three times a week can be as effective as an antidepressant for mild levels of depression, for example, which is huge. Yeah. And when you think about the buildup of cortisol in the body, right, that's what the body releases when people are stressed, that cardiovascular activity is one of the best ways to reduce those cortisol levels in the body. And so when I'm working with a responder and if they are telling me that they're not being physically active, that's going to be one of the first things that I tell them that they need to do is start to integrate some kind of workout into their routine, because the benefits from physical activity are absolutely astounding, in my opinion, and the research is there to back it up.
Yes. And then how about some of the, well, usually with responders, first responders, especially the firefighters, when it comes to their social care, social wellness, they're usually very social, right? I mean, you know, as, I mean, they really master the social piece. But then how about some of the part or anything that you've come across when it comes to that spiritual wellness? Now, whether that's prayer or meditation or sometimes like yoga, meditation and exercise, you know, all together type of thing. What are your thoughts about how that attributes to their overall wellness?
Well, you know, I think that you hit the nail on the head earlier when you were describing just those different, you know, I see them as different domains of wellness, mm-hmm. You know, the physical, the mental, psychological, and I think spiritual is a component of that. And that doesn't necessarily mean that a person has to, you know, be of an organized religion, but that there is some element of, I tell people gratitude, right? So recognizing the positive aspects of life, being grateful for what you have and recognizing those moments throughout the day, being able to meditate on that and be really mindful. That in and of itself, I think is huge. You know, I listened to the podcast that you did with Bobby Kipper the other week, who's also a friend of mine, you know, about his new book, Roll Call, which I wrote an endorsement for. So I support that book. And I think that the spirituality is a huge aspect of wellness. And again, like, as a psychologist, I always fall back on what does the research say about this? Like, where is the data and where is the empirical evidence that this is, you know, the route that we should be following? And it's there too when it comes to spirituality. You know, there's research that says that people who have a belief in some kind of higher power or something that's bigger than themselves, whether that be God or something else, right? That just that there's something out there. When it comes to stress, they're less likely to be stressed, less likely to have, you know, issues of control because they are able to kind of, you know, how we say, give it up to God, right? So they're able to put something and kind of let go of some of that stress. So I think it's huge.
Yes. Well, let me ask you about like within your practice. I want to go straight to some of the struggles that the firefighters and law enforcement officers that when they come to you, because there could definitely be listeners right now that have thought, you know what, I have not gone to a therapist yet. What kind of struggles and issues are people bringing to you?
So it truly runs the gamut. You know, first responders, firefighters, EMS, law enforcement are a microcosm of whatever community that they're in, right? And they're humans and they're going to have human problems just like everybody else. So it can be, you know, what are the things that we all struggle with? Relationship problems, you know, teenage kids and all of their angst and having to raise kids, you know, going through the coronavirus, which we've dealt with for the last year, and all of the stressors with that, financial problems, divorce, you know, anxiety, depression, you name it. So, right, that's the stuff that everybody experiences. But the thing that first responders go through that I think is so truly unique is that the jobs in and of themselves have such an added layer of stress. You know, and the obvious one there is the trauma and the critical incidents that folks go through. And everybody that's a first responder has been through a critical incident at some point. You can't hide from that. So that's a large part of the work that I do. is, you know, individuals who have experienced some kind of trauma on top of all of the other stressors. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, you know, you think about how schedules affect the family, right? So firefighters who are working 24-hour shifts at a time and they're gone, what they're missing out on for law enforcement, especially those who work graves, who are working on the weekends, they're missing out on family time. They're, you know, missing out on their kids' softball games and t-ball and ballet and you name it.
Yeah.
So that's has a huge impact on people. It's all over the place. And so I just think for first responders, a lot of these issues are exacerbated. And, you know, to take on that is that the fact that you are working for a government agency, and with any government agency comes politics and red tape. And so sometimes navigating, you know, just the intricacies within different agencies, and every agency has its own culture, as, you know, I've learned over time, it's all over the place. And so, right, you add in disciplinary issues. I mean, I could go on and on and on about just like the unique stressors that are present for first responders that just truly make the job more difficult.
Oh, yes. And when we talk about critical incidents, could you talk a little bit about the repetition of these critical incidents, even if sometimes the small ones, but are they cumulative?
Absolutely. Well, I'm glad that you brought that up because, you know, I think that when we think about critical incidents, we think about the really big ones. So, right, an officer-involved shooting and an officer has to kill somebody, or, you know, the dead child calls, or, you know, something really big like a mass shooting, or, you know, I mentioned before the building collapse down in Miami, 9/11. We think of those really big things. Yeah. And those are definitely traumatic. And those are the types of incidents that end up getting a lot of attention from departments. And departments will throw resources at stuff like that. But what we know is that over time, it's often the accumulation of a lot of the smaller incidents that tend to add up for people that maybe departments don't put as much resources into. So an incident where an officer has to pull their weapon because they feel that their life is threatened, they don't shoot. You know, they want to, but then they learn that the person didn't have a firearm, something like that. Right. So there's no shooting there. And so the department may not throw anything at it, but the officer has to live with that fear and that second guessing that went through their mind for a while. You know, a fire where there are deceased bodies, motor vehicle accidents, right? So that's something that oftentimes may not be considered a critical incident, but the damage that you see and the death and destruction that you see very much tends to stick with people. And so it is this accumulation over time. It doesn't feel like much is happening after one or two, but over time, what people will notice is, you know, they become more jaded, their sense of humor, which was probably already dark, becomes darker, and people don't find them funny anymore. They just kind of think they're messed up. You know, they start to withdraw. They are less social. They don't want to go out with their family anymore. They're just kind of annoyed all the time. A lot of times what I'll notice is that people will seek out, you know, attempts to feel better, but sometimes it's in the form of alcohol or infidelity.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Talk to me a little bit and to us that the signs that we can look for, you know, how we talk about, because the other thing that, you know, some of this stuff, you know, critical incidents and over time. And of course we can go into the whole suicide, you know, issue and concerns and problems that we have in all first responders. And something I learned about a month ago when I was reading a book about the number of physicians that also medical physicians that commit suicide. I had no idea. I mean, it was an alarming, like over 400 a year in America. For whatever reason, that doesn't seem to make the news, but with the suicide and also just, you know, knowing that the critical incidents can build up, could you go over a little bit more about sort of like those signs that we, you know, if we're in the firehouse or we're in the department or the agency with someone, or if we know them socially, right? What are the things that we can look for? And if we see something, what's a good approach to take to try to get them to help?
Yeah, the best way that I can describe it is that everybody has their baseline. So, you know the people around you and you know what their mood is typically like. You know how social they are. You know if they tend to eat pretty healthy or if they like junk food. You know how often they drink and how much they drink and how often they go out and what their relationship is like with their family. And, how hard of a worker they are. And are they somebody does everything by the book? Or is kind of careless mistakes pretty typical for them? What's their sense of humor like? Whenever you start to see that deviation from baseline in any of those areas, that means that something's going on. And so that's going to be your first thing to think about is, okay, so maybe they're starting to make more mistakes. Is this a go-getter, that runs every call and is always backing people up and is proactive? And all of a sudden they just, you notice that they're taking longer lunches and, they're not as responsive. That's going to be a sign that maybe something's going on. The obvious ones are, if they're drinking more, if they seem irritated, if they, are kind of lashing out with people. That's kind of obvious, but I think those little tiny deviations, that's when you need to kind of start asking those questions and kind of keep your eye on them, and check in with them a little bit more often.
What's a good approach of how to check in? Cause when I talk to people, they're like, well, sometimes I just don't know what to say.
It's a good question. Well, it can go anywhere because it depends on your relationship with the person and, how responsive they are to different types of feedback. So there are some people and they respond really well to confrontation, right? Like, hey, buddy, like I've noted, you haven't shown up for work in the last couple of days. You're always in a pissy mood. What's going on? Right. So some people would respond really well to that very direct kind of blunt and brash type of communication. Some people may need to just say, hey man, like I've noticed this. I'm checking in to make sure you're okay. The thing is that if you ask somebody if they're okay, 100% of the time, probably they're going to say yes. And so you have to be very specific about the behavior that you're noticing that's concerning you, and have them respond to that rather than just checking in. Are you okay?
Yes. No, I like that. And you know what? Your answer gave me something that reminded me of something that I used to do in my training, in leadership training that I would do, is that I would teach how to have awkward conversations. And one of the things that I said is that, the best way to have an awkward conversation is to be proactive at first. And if you're managing a team of people, is to go around to each person and ask them, hey, if I need to address something with you that might be a little awkward, what's the best way for me to do that? And I think we could do that. We could be proactive in our agencies and departments if we go around and say, with people that we work with and say, hey, if I ever see something's off, how would you like for me to approach you with that? Because like you say, some people are like, hey, just hit me between the eyes, just tell me exactly. Other people may say, well, you may need to slowly build up because I don't want to hear it or whatever it may be, right?
It depends on the person. It depends on the relationship, and I think, especially in these public safety agencies is the position, right? So a person's response may be very different, if they're firefighter, or patrol officer, and they've got a chief or deputy chief saying, hey, how you doing? Oh, chief, I'm fine, right? Like they're going to put their best foot forward. Whereas, their sergeant or their captain, maybe that knows them a lot more personally, may get a little bit different answer.
Absolutely. Now, one thing that catches my attention, and I've been hearing it more and more, is that in that we are urging public safety is to go see, like you, a culturally competent therapist. If you would, for those that have never heard of that before, and that I've heard many times too, is that they're reluctant to go see a therapist, or I've heard stories to where they put the therapist in tears. I've heard many of those, right? Could you talk a little bit about seeking out a culturally competent therapist, and what's the difference between someone like that and someone that has not worked in public safety before?
Yeah. So I think that finding somebody that's culturally competent, and what we mean by that is somebody who has an understanding of what you do for work. So somebody that regularly works with first responders and public safety that kind of understands the ins and outs of how agencies are run, you know, the duties of your day-to-day jobs and the trauma that you experience, that that's really important. And I promise that I'm not saying this as like a way to make sure that work doesn't go to other therapists and psychologists, because we're very busy. We need more people to be culturally competent to help us do this work. But the problem is that traditionally first responders have been very reluctant to seek out help. There remains a stigma, and while it's getting better, the stigma is very much still there. And so a lot of times, you know, you've got one chance. And if a responder has one bad experience, they say, that's it. I'm not going back ever again. This wasn't helpful. This made me feel worse. That's what we want to avoid happening, is because a lot of times finding a good therapist, it's like trying, you know, a new medication for something that it's sometimes it's a little bit of trial and error, because you want somebody fit is everything when it comes to therapy. And you're going to find a better fit with somebody that understands and kind of speaks your language, if you will. So that's a big reason. You know, my concern is that the idea of treating first responders has kind of become this like sexy, exciting thing for therapists. And so a lot of therapists are saying that they will treat first responders, or that they do trauma work, which is great. But if I were you and I'm looking for somebody, I would be asking a lot more questions about what their training is. Have they gone on ride-alongs? How many first responders have they treated? You know, what's their understanding about the different agencies in the area? What kind of continuing education have they done? Are they a member of different professional organizations? You know, what percentage of their clientele is first responders? Rather than, you know, okay, cool, you went to a 4-hour training about being culturally competent. Which is a great start, but you want more than that. I mean, this is your mental health. You wouldn't go see a physician, you know, you wouldn't get surgery from a doctor that's done, you know, only two of your type of surgery that you're going to get. So you need to treat your mental health the same way.
No, I completely agree with you with that. Yeah. And now, how do you keep yourself intact with a heavy practice in first responders, hearing about all the incidents, hearing about all the trauma? How do you keep yourself going in the right direction?
So good therapists will have their own therapist.
Yes.
So I do that too. I will practice what I preach. And so I promise it's not because I'm crazy or mentally ill. Believe it or not, people that are not crazy and mentally ill go to therapy. And so I'm just going to try to normalize that for everybody. But it's good to have that person to bounce things off of and to keep you in check. So I do that like once or twice a month. I have a supportive fiance, and so he helps take care of me. I think that staying physically fit, which is what we talked about that earlier, is huge. And so I make sure that I work out at least 5 days a week. I finally started, because I am a yes person. I will say yes to everything. If a responder calls me and they are in crisis, like, I will stay late and get them in. But one of the things that I started doing, because I have the luxury to do so, is blocking out time in my schedule. I actually take a lunch now, which some people thought was the craziest thing, that I just wouldn't eat lunch. So I have lunch now. I block out time for administrative work and report writing, so that I'm not doing that at home when that should be family time, or on the weekends. And I try really hard not to bring work home with me, and I do a good job of that. So everything physically stays in the office. My desk may be a mess, but my house is clean and there's no work.
Awesome. Awesome. Now talk a little bit more about you. You work out 5 days a week, and I just want to reemphasize the point. Why is that so important to you? What benefit are you getting from that?
Well, working out for me is a form of therapy. It's that moment of escape where you can just kind of put in your earbuds, crank up some music, and then just go. There's, there's nobody that I'm talking to on the phone. I'm not responding to emails. that is my time for me. So I think that that's huge. And, you know, you get kind of that, you know, some people will call it a runner's high. I'm not a runner, but you kind of get that high from working out, right? Where you're, all of those endorphins are flowing. And so that's huge for mood and just kind of staying sane. And there's some vanity to it too, you know?
Sure.
I'm not afraid to admit that.
Oh, I understand. Let's talk about the future. What do you dream about? What are you hopeful for? What's the future going to bring?
Hopefully some good stuff. I tend to be very work career oriented. So whenever I'm asked about the future, I think about that first. So, you know, my practice will grow. I think that there's a huge need when it comes to supporting the mental health needs of first responders. And so my intention is to grow so that I can provide not quite little clones of me, but people who are culturally competent and can help to treat people. And I want to spread the word as much and try to destigmatize mental illness and encourage especially mental wellness, but all aspects of wellness as much as I can. And so, you know, I'm going to continue to speak out about that and continue to support first responders as publicly as possible to try to make that happen. Personally, you know, pandemic is lifting, right? We're going to, like, now I can actually practice what I preach and have a better work-life balance and travel a little bit more and take some time off and kind of use that time to re-energize my body and mind so that I can, you know, continue to pour my heart into the work that I do.
Yes. That's awesome.
Yeah.
All right. My son will be working on entering. Well, he's a paid on call firefighter. He's running EMS right now. He's a combat veteran, Afghanistan. And what advice do you have for the young folks coming into public safety? I guess advice, and I guess give them some inspiration to seek out mental health before it's necessarily needed. Cause that's one thing, by the way, that I try to preach about is that, you know, we all go out and get our preventive health checkups. Why aren't we out doing preventive or just mental wellness checkups? You know, why wait for a incident or why wait until things get bad versus, yes, hey, check in with someone, I don't know, once every 6 months or something, and have a therapist that you check in with. I guess that's probably maybe driven a little bit about insurance. I don't know, but it seems like it'd be a good practice. What are your thoughts on that? And any advice that you have for the young folks?
Well, I love that you mentioned that. There are a number of agencies that are starting to implement wellness programs where that is a part of it, where you can meet with, you know, you meet with a department psychologist or one of them, paid for by the department, you know, once or twice a year. And it's just kind of a check-in, you know, how are you sleeping? How are you eating? What have you been through lately? You know, here's some tips. And while a lot of people will say, you know, of course I'm doing fine, there's no issues, I'm doing this because I have to, it's a formality. Yeah. It creates a relationship with somebody so that that comfort is there, you know, if something happens. So I think that that's great. You know, departments, if there's any executives listening to, right, they may shy away from this because of course it's going to cost money. But the thing is that in the long run, you know, when you take care of your employees' wellness, you see increased presenteeism. So people are, you know, actually present and mindful while they're working and in the moment and not thinking about their stresses, less turnover, less people calling out sick. And so the return on investment is actually high.
Yeah.
When it comes to implementing this type of stuff. So I hope that this continues, you know, across the country. Some agencies are starting it. Some agencies just do it for people who work in certain positions. You know, if you're working, you know, child crimes, stuff like that. But my advice to people entering the profession is to have hope. Cause Lord knows we need you. There's going to be a lot of turnover here soon and a lot of retirements, and we're seeing it already. And so we really need good people with good hearts that are working in these jobs. And so the best thing that you can do, you know, you will hear war stories in the academy from people and veterans that are on the job about, you know, how horrible this is and how it affects your family and how people are driven to drink and all of the trauma. But seek out the good stories about, you know, the calls that have positively impacted people. Take care of yourself. The best thing that you can do is to kind of keep things simple. And not try to overextend yourself and work all of this off duty and overtime. Start doing that from the beginning. Recognize that the job doesn't have to change you. A lot of people will say that it does, that they, you know, they find themselves more cynical over time and jaded, but that doesn't have to be the case. And I think that, you know, a lot of the stuff that you talk about this work-life balance is one of the keys to making sure that that doesn't happen. And so if people can start that and start implementing those tools early on in their career, it's going to be a long and healthy career that feels very purposeful. And that's the last point, is truly remembering what your purpose is. When you have one of those bad days where it feels like everything is going wrong.
Yeah. And if they have all that and they're taking great care of themselves, then when they retire, we can get that average age or life expectancy after retirement. We have to really increase that number, because that number's not that attractive right now.
There used to be this statistic that they would always share in the academy about, like, how the average, you know, length, the average age that people, you know, would die after retirement is like 5 years after you retire, you're going to die from a heart attack. It was like this, like, really scary number.
Yeah.
And there's no truth behind it. And I don't know why they keep throwing that number out there.
Well, that's been a number. Yeah. 5, 6, 7 years is a number that sort of I've been hearing all the time. So I'm glad to hear that if there's not any truth about that, I will be one to stop using it. Yeah.
It's a myth that's been, you know, maybe it was true 30 years ago, but, I mean, it's still, right. It still is a shorter life expectancy, than for people who don't work in a high stress occupation. But retirement can be very fruitful. And one of the keys to that is, you know, throughout your career, have as many identities and hats that you wear as possible. You know, so if your identity is completely in, you know, being a firefighter and being a cop, guess what? A day will come where that ends. And so, you know, you also need to equally give that the identities of being a mother, a father, you know, a friend, a congregant, whatever it is, all of those different roles that you play in your life, you have to give those equal attention.
Absolutely. Now, Dr. Coleman, is there anything that I did not ask you as we're coming to a close here that you wished I would have, or anything you'd like to spend more time on?
I can't think of it. I feel like we covered like a whole lot in our 40 minutes here.
Yes. Yes. All right. Well, I absolutely appreciate you being my guest on the show. And one of my traditions, if you've listened to the podcast, is that you don't have to, but the offer is there if you'd like to close this podcast out with a blessing to all the public safety personnel out there.
Sure. I'm like very much on the spot, but I will go for it.
All right.
All right. Dear Lord, thank you so much for all of the fine men and women who continue to serve and to protect us, for our firefighters, police officers, EMS, deputies. And I'd like to extend that to healthcare professionals too, who take care of us as well. I hope that you can serve them and bless them with good mental, physical, spiritual health, so that they can have long-lasting careers, long-lasting lives, and healthy relationships.
Amen.
Amen.
Well, thank you, Dr. Coleman, for all you do for all first responders and for all you're doing with all your training that you do and the therapy and the sessions and spreading the word and helping all that you really do. And you do quite a bit. So thank you for that. And I wanted to let you know that I really appreciate you, as I'm sure many, many do. So thank you again for being the guest on the Get Balanced podcast.
That's my pleasure. Thank you.
Hey, if you're a firefighter, law enforcement officer, or EMS professional who enjoys this podcast,
and would like some help with your work-life balance, you need to check out my Get Balanced program. Not sure if you are balanced or not? Join me over at DonnieHutchinson.com and take the quiz. Together, we are going to get you balanced.